Hi, I'm Kate Dearden, and you're listening to the Migration Podcast. In this episode, you'll hear Ruz Derix chat with two migration scholars, Yerasimos Tsourapas and Kamal Sadiq, about their latest project on South-South labor migration. They are looking at the role of sending states and how they establish what they call a post-colonial social contract with their citizens. They explained how, in this context, the agency of migrants from these countries is curtailed through surveillance and the commodification of their labor. Yerasimos and Kamal argue that innovative methods and scholarship in the Global South are needed to further untangle and to understand these practices.
You recently started a project focusing on labor migration and specifically South-South labor migration, focusing on the role of the sending state, which is something that has been under research. So could you tell us a bit more about that to start with?
Sure. Essentially, what we're trying to do with my colleague Kamal is to intervene in how the field of the international politics of migration has been progressing. So a lot of the earlier literature looks at the Western states, so North America and Europe. Slowly over the past decade, we've started bringing in the Global South, but only vis-a-vis the Global North. So the literature on state diaspora relations, literature on emigration, does focus on the Global South, but still our point of reference continues to be the countries of destination in Europe, in North America, and so on and so forth. So the way we're shifting this a bit with Kamal is by looking at South-South migration. We argue in this piece and in previous work that we should be engaging in a migration from below kind of methodology, as we would call it, that essentially places the countries of the Global South front and center and doesn't actually give us any kind of reference point vis-a-vis the Global North.
You come into the project maybe at a different place from where other researchers would start, which is the post-colonial migration states. And from there, you develop other concepts like post-independent social contract and transnational social contract. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, one of the things that we do is to distinguish between what is the non-West, what is the Global South, and what are the post-colonial states. And some of the states in the non-West are neither post-colonial nor located within the Global South, such as Russia and Eastern Europe. Some of the Global South states were never formally colonized, such as Turkey, Thailand, Saudi Arabia. And so we narrow the pool of what we are talking about in post-colonial. We are talking about those states that achieved independence following a period and process of decolonization in relation to a colonial or imperial power. This also means there is a post-independence contractual language of rights to distinguish our global post-colonial states in the South from, let's say, earlier rounds of independence that took place from Spanish colonialism.
And so can you explain a bit more about what specifically is this post-independent social contract that came about in the independence period of countries?
Sure. I'll give you a case, which is in my first book on Egypt. So Egypt becomes independent from the British in the 1950s, and essentially Gamal Abdel Nasser comes in and promises a new post-independent social contract in which the state is at the heart of employment, social welfare, and public provision of goods. That means that for anybody that essentially has the level of education necessary should be able to get a job. Education, health is made free for all, and so on. So this is the kind of social contract we examine in Nepal and Jordan in our international studies quarterly piece. And that has distinct political connotations, we argue, that allows for a certain type of relationship between the state and society to develop. The problem comes a few decades later in the 1970s, where for a number of reasons, a lot of these states, including Egypt, Nepal, Jordan, are unable to finance this post-independence social contract. And what we argue in the piece is that, well, this didn't create a break in terms of how states relate to their societies because migration came in. So these people that were reliant on the state, the Egyptian state, the Nepalese state, the Jordanian state, are now still reliant on the state, but not to be employed domestically, but to secure employment somewhere else. So migration comes in and essentially substitutes the post-independent social contract into what we call a transnational social contract something that has been happening from the 70s up until today.
So in the project, you focus on two sending states as case studies, so two post-colonial migration states that are sending labor migrants, and these are Nepal and Jordan. So could you explain a bit more about the post-independent social contract and the transnational social contract and what it implies for those two countries?
Well, one of the things that happens is there's a gap that develops between remittances that occur and the welfare spending of these states. Even as remittances go up for these countries, with increasing labor emigration, for example, to the Gulf from both Jordan and Nepal, what is happening is the spending on housing, on food, on education, basic sustenance of people remains stagnant. In the case of Nepal, it remains at about 5% or below for recent decades. What does this tell us? It tells us that remittance spending is not being utilized by governments to increase the welfare of these people, and people's own household consumption, a big chunk of it, is being spent on basic food, etc. So it's not savings. It's not future financial stability. Therefore, what was considered a social contract between the citizen and the state has now become transnationalized. And that's something I think we want to focus on, because it means there are three actors. One is the sending state, one is the host state, and then there's the citizen who becomes the migrant, right? And this is important because it gives the sending state some of the veto power. We say that there are two conditions that are important for a transnational social contract, and that is that they should have the right to seek employment abroad, right to exit, and that should exist. And the second is the countries they go to may not have formal membership. In the global south, you don't get access to citizenship or formal naturalization. They are weakly institutionalized. Therefore, both their right to exit and their right to membership is conditional in the transnational social contract in the global south.
So Kamal talked about this gap between remittances and welfare. The second condition is the existence of diaspora institutions. And we see that quite heavily in the case of Jordan. From the 1950s, 1960s onwards, the Jordanian state realizes that there's something there, that there is power to be harnessed in terms of sending people to the Gulf, encouraging remittances, lowering unemployment, reaching out to these people for all sorts of things. So that's the second part of this aspect of the transnational social contract that we see both in Jordan, Nepal, but also elsewhere, of course.
And can you elaborate a bit why you focused on Nepal and Jordan and the labor migrants that go from these countries to the Gulf Cooperation Council states?
I would say it goes back to your first question about why do we focus on South-South migration. And one of the fascinating things that has emerged out of our conversations is the extent to which regions are so similar to one another. So what we see in the case of South-South migration is that processes that take place in the Middle East are very similar to the processes that take place in South Asia and Southeast Asia. I would also say they are reminiscent of what's taking place in sub-Saharan African states in many ways. So our choice to focus on one case in the Middle East and one case outside it, in this case in South Asia, has to do essentially with our desire to bridge these gaps between area studies and to identify how we can theorize by bringing countries that are normally not really considered comparable, by bringing them together.
I think what we are trying to do also is to show that the trajectories of their legal and legislative and their bureaucratic development has some overlap in terms of processes. And therefore, you're going to find that these states, while trying to encourage emigration through these institutional means, are also incorporating some level of rethinking the relationship between the citizen and who becomes their migrant, right? And that's very important. In future research, scholars will have to disaggregate this relationship in a very micro way and look at laws, legislation, bureaucratic procedures, protocols, etc., to unravel exactly how this relationship between the citizen migrant is changing with regard to sending state or the host state. Oftentimes, the role of the sending state becomes very invisible. So we'd like to bring the attention back to the sending state's role.
So you highlight how the transnational social contract also leads to coercion of these citizens / migrants. Can you tell a bit more, also with examples, how this coercion takes place?
Well, for example, it's common to now read in human rights reports that there is delayed or unpaid wages. There's lack of overtime payments. There's contract substitution, lack of departure payments, right? Or that the migrant has to bear the recruitment fees himself or herself. What this means is we have created a condition where migrants are in debt bondage, which makes them further vulnerable. And there's a privileging of employers, which makes accountability difficult. But this starts very much in the sending state itself. And, you know, when you say that labor is giving consent, you basically, whatever they sign before going becomes like an irreversible labor contract, which means they can, once they land in the host state, there is no renegotiation of the contract. The contract remains. And in some way, this is what modern consent is. Therefore, we have to really look at government-to-government negotiations, bilateral labor agreements, and memorandums of understanding to show how commodification and coercion, both of them, are being institutionalized between host and sending states, how misrepresentation of work contracts, salaries, housing arrangements, lack of medical facilities is institutionalized, where failure to provide receipts or contact information has become so common, besides wage abuse. And it's not just Nepal or Jordan. It goes across. Emigrants from Bangladesh, from Indonesia, Sri Lanka are experiencing this in South Asia as well as other countries in the Middle East.
In the case of a Middle East migration to the Gulf, the phenomena of debt bondage are not as extensive as they might be in South and Southeast Asia. But what we see different in the Middle East is an existence of non-democratic or authoritarian governments across these countries of origin. And that sets the stage for a very different type of transnational coercion or transnational authoritarianism, not around money necessarily, but in terms of people not getting permission to emigrate, people having to go through specific channels that are often tied to a ruling regime, people being denied randomly the permission to leave a country because of something they might have written or something they might have said. So that's what we identify in cases of the Middle East.
I want to discuss with you the agency of citizens/migrants, because in the project you apply a historical institutionalist perspective, which implies that you look at bigger structures, for example, the veto power of the sending state. What does this imply for the agency of the migrants, citizen?
One of the things you have to take into account are two trends here that are happening both in South Asia and in other regions. And that is the expansion of surveillance capability from migrant IDs to biometric data collection. And the second is the state's increasing use of veto power in terms of banning certain age groups, restricting female workers, limiting quotas, banning people of certain age, etc., which means labor migration is increasingly becoming a foreign policy tool bilaterally. So what does this mean for migrants agency? It means that technology becomes a powerful tool for them. Perhaps increasing use of documenting abuse from videos and photos, creating support groups by coordinating, information sharing, these kinds of acts to push back against manpower agencies or other culpable actors will have to be emphasized. Because in a sense, the migrant and the citizen is, in terms of commodification, is on their own. If both host state and sending state have some kind of stable understanding between each other. Perhaps Gerasimus might want to say something else.
I would just add to this, and you're absolutely right in the sense that a historical institutionalist approach doesn't highlight questions of agency or put them at the very front of the analysis. That is not to say that we believe that these migrants or citizen migrants are devoid of agency. And in fact, if you look at this corridor, the South Asia Gulf corridor, if you look carefully, you will see citizens going against state directives, both at the country of destination and at the country of origin perspective. So one of the things that we observe in South-South migration is how able these people are to know what's happening and to be able to manipulate the situation to their own advantage to the extent possible. So there's definitely room here for agency, even if this particular paper doesn't highlight it.
Thank you very much. We have spoken about coercion and commodification, so I was wondering whether you would like to clarify these topics.
I think one of the key things we have to understand is there is both de jure and de facto coercion happening. And so both visible and invisible forms of coercion will have to be studied more. And then secondly, in future research, some of these states in South Asia and Middle East will also have to be examined as to whether some of these practices come from British or French or Portuguese colonial times, whether some of these have been adopted by modern states in their policy making. And that would be very interesting to see to what extent are these states replicating or adapting some of the old practices. But the other thing that I think we want to emphasize is that commodification is very common. And states, both sending and host states, are on the same page with regard to this. Therefore, for doing this, you will have to dive into neglected archives, craft new kind of tools in the Global South. Global South-centric data will have to become valuable because this then requires innovation on our part. What are the kinds of data that we have neglected? What are the kind of agencies we have neglected that are present in the archives?
If I may add to this, that goes back to the initial point about the benefits or the strengths of South-South migration. And one of the things here, when we look at commodification, which is essentially the use of citizens as commodities, right, in the marketplace. This is Karl Polanyi back in the day. One of the things that we observe is the extent to which the category, the fixed category between who is a migrant and who is a refugee, doesn't really make a lot of sense. So a South-South perspective on migration looks at commodification and looks not only historically, as Kamal said, in terms of linkages to colonial and post-colonial policies, but also in terms of these largely artificial categories that we in the North have constructed, dividing very neatly the category of migrant and the category of refugee, whereas in reality, both of them fall victim to processes of commodification on a daily basis.
There's lots of interesting things to do further research on. So what is your plan for the future? What are the next steps that you will undertake within this large project?
Well, rather than do single case studies, we are trying to pool our resources to see what kind of characteristics, institutional characteristics, come out when we compare two big regions that normally are not compared, but were historically part of migrant and labor flows. So in a sense, cross-regional work across perhaps sometimes migration subsystems. For example, in our case, the migration subsystem in South Asia and the migration subsystem in the Middle East. Migration subsystems in sub-Saharan Africa or Southeast Asia can be compared. And therefore, we are calling for a cross-regional comparison. And we're also saying that, look, these theoretical categories that we have had from this emphasis on South-North have to be rethought. Or maybe we need innovation and new categories to be introduced. And that's a long-term project. And me and Gerasimus's collaboration is just the initial step.
I totally support this. We can't do this alone. And these debates are taking place in different disciplines. Some are more open to discussion than others. But what we're doing right now is talking to people in global history, in anthropology, in sociology, and trying to see where the debates that we're only now beginning to uncover in political science and international relations, at which stage are they in other disciplines? What can we offer from our perspective, and what can we borrow from longer debates that have been had for a number of years? And this is, I think, something to leave your listeners with, that they need to read more widely, perhaps, than they are used to, but also that we should keep supporting interdisciplinary organizations and institutions like EMISCO.
Kamal Sadiq is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science and the director of the Center for Global Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of California, Irvine. And Gerasimos Tsourapas is a professor of international relations in the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Glasgow. If you enjoy the Migration Podcast, please consider liking and following us. Thanks for listening.